We would like to take a moment to thank our sponsor, Preborn. When a mother meets her baby on an ultrasound and hears their heartbeat, it's a divine connection, and the majority of the time, she will choose life. But she can't do it without our help. Preborn needs us, the pro-life community, to come alongside her. One ultrasound is just $28. To donate, dial #250 and say the keyword baby, or visit preborn.com.
Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
I love talking about the things of God because of truth and the biblical worldview.
The U.S. Constitution obligates our government to preserve and protect the rights that our founders recognize come from God, our Creator, not our government. I believe that Scripture in the Bible is very clear that God is the one that raised up each of you, and God has allowed us to be brought here to this specific moment in time.
This is Jenna Ellis in the Morning.
Good morning. Good morning. Well, I hope you had a fantastic weekend talking about what exactly happened in the Oval Office between President Trump, Vice President J.D. Vance, a very uncomfortable looking Marco Rubio, Secretary of State, and Ukraine President Vladimir Zelensky. And now, this coming from Town Hall, the United Kingdom and France are working together to form a coalition of the willing, is what they're terming it apparently, to craft a peace plan for Ukraine, which they intend to present to President Trump. The move comes as both European nations seek to address the ongoing conflict between Ukraine and Russia and anticipate a potential shift in U.S. foreign policy under Trump's leadership. But this coming, of course, after this mineral deal wasn't signed, even though some members of the White House and aides were saying that it was all but signed. And then, of course, we had kind of the Oval Office fiasco. So what exactly happened and what is going on? Let's welcome in Scott Uhlinger, who is a former naval officer. And Scott, I think the main question here is that the left is saying that this was a setup with Zelensky. I think if you look at the entire press conference and the entire meeting, it was clear that Zelensky was just there kind of in a petulant sort of mood and insulting Trump and Vance while asking for help on behalf of his country. Maybe not a smart move if you've, you know, been around Donald Trump for 5 minutes or, you know, even seen how he operates. But what was the deal supposed to be? And then how did it kind of get off the rails?
Well, good morning, Jenna. The deal was supposed to be signed after that press conference at a luncheon. And so this is one reason why we saw Rubio was clearly so angry, because he had been absolutely basically lied to in Kiev. Apparently, Zelensky and the Kiev authorities insisted that the deal be signed in Washington instead of just in Kiev by the Secretary of State or something. So they came over to D.C. for the purposes of signing this. And at that moment, it was apparently Zelensky decided he wanted to start changing the conditions of the deal in front of the world press. And somehow in his mind, he thought that was a good idea to contradict the president and vice president, you know, and as well as an American public that had given him over $350 billion in aid so far. So this was like a diplomatic meltdown that I've never seen before in my life, a disaster on Zelensky's part, because he basically sunk his cause with a lot of the American people. A lot of some polling shows that, you know, Zelensky is now in the basement as far as his approval with the American public. And it's understandable because of his behavior.
Yeah, and I think that it was no surprise, really, that he showed up in the outfit that he did. I mean, I personally wasn't any more surprised by that than John Fetterman showing up at the Senate in gym shorts. I mean, that's just kind of what he's known at. And if that had been kind of the extent of the perceived mockery, maybe, or just rudeness to the White House, I think that they would have gotten this deal done. I think that the joke that Trump kind of made as he was welcoming him in was very Trumpian and was actually in good humor. So where did this seem to go off the rails in the White House? Was it the insults from Zelensky, or was it something else?
No, I think it was basically, he was trying to, from having watched it, you know, he was basically trying to insert some extra provisions. He was insisting on, the quote is, security guarantees. Now, with the mineral deal being done, and a lot of the areas that are mineral rich happen to be near, let's say, the line of contact where the fighting is going on. Basically, it doesn't take a genius to figure out that, in fact, if the U.S. and Ukraine were going to collaborate on minerals, that the United States would be kind of near the line of contact. In other words, that's sort of a, if there's American mining companies there or whatever, that's sort of a guarantee that things aren't going to get out of hand because there are Americans in these areas. And that wasn't good enough for Zelensky. Zelensky should also understand that the way Trump is, his character, he would brook no betrayal of a peace treaty. I mean, if Putin were to attack Ukraine after a peace treaty was signed, that would be, I think, interpreted by Trump as a personal affront. It would enrage him, and then Russia would suffer the consequences. So in other words, these security guarantees, quote unquote, were already implicit in the agreement. But that wasn't good enough for Zelensky. Zelensky had to go an extra step, maybe because he's used to dealing with a brain dead Biden or an the EU or the Biden administration, which bent over backwards to give him anything he wanted. He just had to get that final word in, and by doing so, he destroyed himself.
Well, and which is never a good idea when you're going up against Donald Trump. I'm speaking with Scott Uhlinger, who is a former naval officer, about this Oval Office meeting that has become the topic, of course, over the weekend. So now these other European nations are, I think, getting more involved potentially. Really, Trump has told them for a while, hey, you're not really doing anything to help this conflict. The UK Prime Minister Keir Starmer basically said, we want to put together this this package. We want to help, but we can't do that without the United States being on board. So where does this go from here? And is this sort of just posturing from some of the other European countries?
Well, that's a very interesting question, because really in all of this, the strangest, most contradictory behavior is with the Europeans. Listeners have to understand, I was in the CIA and the Navy. I spent years operating in NATO navies, and I have literally a real life experience dealing with NATO navies. But this is when I'm talking about the 90s. Between the 90s and the year 2025, the capability of the European militaries has gone down immeasurably, like two-thirds lower than what I remember. They've spent all their money on social services, illegal immigrants, and they have no money for defense. And this is one thing that Trump was making a big deal of in the first term. And he was absolutely right. I've been noting it for 20 years myself. So the Europeans tend to act like they have some kind of a military capability, like that they could send peacekeepers in. The Europeans would be strained to send 30,000 peacekeepers in. The British Army has as many tanks as the National Guard of Pennsylvania. It really is pathetic if you look at the numbers. But these countries insist on wanting a place at the table as if they're real players. It's like a midget taking on Michael Tyson. It's insane. Now, Starmer now seems to maybe be getting a little bit of a clue as to realism, saying that he really does need the United States to lead. And it's absolutely a fact. That's why Putin wouldn't even waste his time talking to the Europeans. The Europeans also seem to be halfway inclined to continue the war, as if that would be a good thing for Europe, which it certainly would not be. Clearly, peace is the only solution in this case. Ukraine has done a good job, but cannot do any more. And we have to be realistic and sit down. The Europeans seem, relatively speaking, to be just ignoring this reality. Maybe now they're coming around a little bit. Maybe now they'll come to Trump and propose something that might involve, you got to keep the two warring parties apart. So that would involve a peacekeeping force, which Trump has insisted the United States will not take part in, as he is correct in saying, because this is the Europeans' backyard. It literally is in Europe. And so the onus is on them to you know, provide, contribute to the mission. And so maybe this fallout will result in the Europeans making an actual contribution to the mission. So it's possible that we may be able to salvage something out of this. But Trump's insistence that, which is very important and very good, his insistence that he is willing to walk away from a bad deal is absolutely essential. It's very clear he's willing to do that. And that has left the Europeans scrambling.
Which Donald Trump has got to know all of this, right? That the European leaders can't really make all that much of a difference without the United States. And I was frankly surprised to hear Keir Starmer just say that so bluntly, which is an acknowledgement of Donald Trump's superior negotiating position, which I'm sure he appreciated that at least, just in that respect. But where is the United States in this in terms of just our national interest or some kind of metric for which we should be contributing to Ukraine? I mean, obviously, there is the flip side of this to say, well, you know, if you're not for Ukraine, then you're for Russia and Putin, which is, you know, the worst. I mean, that's like the worst thing you could say in America right now, probably even over, you know, calling him a racist, you know, Trump. Oh, if Trump is for Putin, that's really bad, you know, but nobody has really identified an American interest. And polls have also suggested that American sentiment toward Ukraine is really divided and very significantly among partisan lines. Quickly, a CBS poll that was just published yesterday found that 52% of respondents back Ukraine in its conflict with Russia, while 44% remain neutral and only 4% support Russia. And I think the neutrality here is really where a lot of conservatives are saying, like, you know, this is more of Europe's problem. Like, why is America involved to begin with?
Right. Certainly, if Trump, like, basically in an attempt to get back some of the money, the huge amounts of money that we've sent Ukraine, the mineral deal would mean there would be some U.S. interests. But basically, there is a lack of U.S. interests. And also, another thing in the chess game of foreign diplomacy is that what the United States is really concerned about, as well it should be, is China. Okay, China's increased aggression in the Pacific. And the United States is looking at pivoting away from Europe, which it has been focused on for more than 45, 50 years. So for the first time in 50 years, we are trying to pivot to the east because the real threat is China. And so part of the strategy of concluding this Ukrainian deal, first of all, it's common sense to want to do that, is that it's an attempt. It is also gives us the benefit of trying to peel Russia away from China a little bit. Because the two of them together, Russia's, you know, China's manpower and capability combined with Russian national resources is not a good thing for the United States. So this, we're trying to get like something out of this by peeling maybe Russia away from China a little bit, by making it less of an enemy. It may be deemed a failure, but it's worth a try. Is I think an integral part of the U.S. strategy, because we're looking try to 5 years ahead or so. And, you know, war with China could be coming the same way that war with Japan was increasingly obvious in 1935. So this is all part of the international chess game. And so and that's where we're at right now, I think.
Which is a really interesting position, I think, and way better to have Donald Trump at the helm of negotiating this for the United States. And of course, Secretary of State Marco Rubio, instead of obviously the Biden administration that you know, nobody just trusted Biden to be doing anything. And now that there are even aides that are admitting that Biden didn't have his full mental faculties during the presidency, is just shocking and wild. But where are we at, Scott Uhlinger, in terms of Ukraine's consistent request? I don't know if it's necessarily a demand, but at least their request to join NATO. I mean, Zelensky has even said he would step down as president if that were to happen, which, of course, that just plays into what he's asking in terms of the security backing over anything else.
Well, that's just, I think at this point, that's just not going to happen. But keep in mind that even right now in its weakened state with less money coming in, the Ukrainian military capability is probably greater than most of NATO combined, except maybe France and England. The Ukrainians retain a distinct combat ability. And so, in other words, that guarantees that there will not be a resumption of the war because they still have that ability. So I think that that, combined with Trump's skeptical view of NATO, means that Ukraine really doesn't have a path into NATO.
And I think that's probably accurate analysis, and particularly because of where Russia is seated. And so let's also talk quickly before I let you go, Scott Uhlinger, about the Democrats and all of this. I mean, obviously, nobody really cares when they're in the minority what they have to say. But Zelensky might have. Senator Amy Klobuchar posted a photo of her and another senator and then Lindsey Graham, which I'm kind of like, well, that's in a sense a cadre of Democrats. We'll just, you know, he's the warmonger. We'll just throw him in there, too. But with Zelensky ahead of the White House meeting. So there's some speculation that perhaps that meeting was advising Zelensky to go into the Oval Office and be as pushy and maybe brash, however you want to characterize it, in the Oval Office meeting. And then Lindsey Graham, of course, then comes out and supports Trump after that, maybe because he knows the optics won't be favorable to him if something came out of that meeting. But do you think that there's any truth to that speculation?
I think that it might be true that they were giving him, quote, advice on how to tackle Trump, but it's clear, I mean, that the advice was absolutely wrong. I certainly would have advised nothing of the kind. So it is possible that they kind of goaded him or encouraged him to try to create a little bit of a flap, which certainly happened. So that was bad. And it is interesting that Lindsey Graham was very willing to disavow Zelensky, as you pointed out, because the optics were so disastrous that even Lindsey Graham would look ridiculous supporting Zelensky at that point. You know, I guess you have to understand the Democratic view, you know, why this support of Zelensky. You know, liberals and Democrats, believe me, as a Russian speaker who chased after Russians in the CIA, I say this with authority, that, you know, Democrats for 50 years have been apologists of the Russians. Why this sudden switch? And it has to do with globalism, because they want to support a globalist, like, forever war that enriches the arms manufacturers of the world and doesn't, you know, basically it's a very short-term view. Okay, let's just keep this war going, kill Russians, and we make, you know, Raytheon and Grumman more wealthy and everything's hunky-dory. But Americans are increasingly rejecting this globalist view. The European elite, not the people, since they dominate and they run the EU with their suppression of civil rights and stuff, the EU is absolutely still in the globalist camp. And that is why they still seem to support Zelensky to the nth degree, even after this disaster of a press conference. You know, Trump obviously is an anti-globalist candidate, and it's another reason why the Europeans really hate him, because he calls out the truths of life in Europe, et cetera, and they hate that. But that is like the source. This globalist view is the source of the support for Zelensky and the hatred of Putin, even though, like I said, 20 years ago, the Democrats were very happy to be Putin's lapdog. Now suddenly they're on the opposite side because it suits their interests.
And isn't that always how it is? It's always about something else than what it appears to be. And this is why commentary with authority like yours, Scott Uhlinger, is so important to actually understanding the fuller situation. And it was fascinating to me. Elon Musk posted or reposted a photo, and it was almost like a cartoon depiction yesterday on X that showed a chessboard and had all of the white and black pieces other than the kings and queens that were off to the side.
I've seen it.
All of those, yeah, that were basically dead on the battlefield, you know, looking bloodied. And then on the side, the kings and queens, both the black and the white, for listeners who haven't seen it, were sitting off to the side at a table having dinner together. And I thought, what a perfect picture of what war does to countries.
Right. And this war is more, it's this break between the wants of the globalists and the regular people. This war is even more distinct than most. You know, you're arguing World War II was a war of necessity. World War I was not. But this war, you know, maybe started as a war of necessity in the sense that, okay, Russia did invade. But at the end of the day, you know, Trump is concerned about saving lives because so many lives have been lost, about a million total casualties, deaths and people wounded. And it just has to end, because are we just going to like contribute? Are the Europeans and the United States going to contribute money until literally the last Ukrainian is dead? How does that benefit the human race and Ukraine in particular?
Yeah, well said. And this is also why so many people are so against the United States potentially having boots on the ground or, you know, any kind of escalation like that. Certainly as a taxpayer, I would love to see us get some of our money back. But at the cost of the human casualties, that's certainly a moral question beyond just these globalist warmongers. So, Scott Uhlinger, this is going to be really fascinating to see how all of this plays out. Always appreciate your commentary. And we will be right back with more here on Jenna Ellis in the Morning. If we have learned anything from the 2024 election, it's how important it is for us to fight, fight, fight. We also learned how desperately the left wants to fight to take babies' lives, which is why every day Preborn Ministries fights for the babies. Preborn's network of clinics are positioned in the highest abortion areas, fighting for mothers deciding between the life and death of their child. Preborn welcomes these women with God's love and offers them a free ultrasound to introduce their precious baby and hear the beautiful heartbeat. This amazing encounter gives her baby a fighting chance, and the majority of the time, she will choose life. So would you join Preborn in the fight for life? One ultrasound is just $28, and $140 will sponsor 5 ultrasounds. Babies are worth fighting for. To donate, dial #250 on your cell phone and say the keyword baby. That's #250 baby. Or you can visit preborn.com/AFR. That's preborn.com/AFR. All gifts are tax deductible, and Preborn has a 4-star charity rating. Fight, fight, fight for the babies.
Welcome back to Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
Welcome back. And over the weekend as well, beyond the Oval Office meeting with Trump and Zelensky, there were two other controversies that conservatives have been discussing, mainly Andrew Tate and the Tate brothers returning to America as U.S.-UK dual citizens from Romania. And then also the release, or really non-release, and the utter disappointment of the Epstein files. So these are two topics that have been really controversial with a lot of different opinions. And I want to comment on both of those and give you my take on both of those controversies. But before we do that, I think it's very important for us at the American Family Radio Network and our AFR family as Christians to understand first how to think through some of these issues before we just go and take them as they come. And of course, for regular listeners of this show, we talk about the biblical worldview all the time. And so if you are a new listener, this will be even more important, I think, for you. But for people who've been regular listeners, even before I started here, I think it's always important to come back to the foundation, because otherwise we can very easily try to just address issue by issue without saying, okay, first of all, we need to understand what a biblical worldview lens is. And I love when this happens, and it happens so frequently, I think, just because, you know, the Bible always speaks to things that are so relevant in how we are to live as Christians. But my pastor yesterday at church talked about exactly this, and it was the perfect setup. And so I want to borrow some of my notes from yesterday's sermon as we lay this out and talk about how we need to build our foundation as Christians first before we address various topics or conflicts. And this is true for any issue. This is true for decision making as an individual Christian. This is true for decisions you make as a family, parents make for kids, how you treat each other, how you, you know, how we recognize who is our neighbor. That's a question the leftists always love to ask. And it's also true for how we engage civil society and how we engage different types of questions, news events, and controversy. And how we always frame kind of the civil government view in the constitutional framework, I always like to say, and it's true, that our rights are God-given, they're pre-political. And so we first have to understand what our rights are before then we can argue how the Constitution is designed to preserve and protect those rights, and how we have the freedom and liberty for free exercise, and then how the government is not permitted to infringe upon those rights. But the point of our rights being pre-political is exactly the same point that our morality should be pre-political. Our foundation needs to be pre-political. Our foundation of moral truth is the same yesterday, today, and forever. Because why? God, as the divine lawgiver, as the person of truth, does not change. He's the same yesterday, today, and forever. So the exact same morality, the same truth, the same nature of God's character has been true for every political question, cultural question, family question, Christian life question throughout human history. Now, the application might be different because different circumstances or contexts, but the moral principle remains the same. That's why truth is objective, not subjective. This is why we don't go with the cultural sway. We don't go with our emotions. We don't go with societal expectations. We don't modify our morals based on the culture or the politics. We always have to have that firm foundation in objective truth. And this is why the Bible talks about rightly dividing truth from error, and why the Bible gives us the master plan of how we live our Christian life according to those principles. Now, in the very same way, when we talk about, for example, the context of the First Amendment and protecting the pre-political right to free speech or free exercise of religion, those things, free speech looks different today in 2025, and you know, the platform of social media or the platform of radio that we're communicating on right now. That's different, and those options weren't available when the founders ratified the original Constitution in 1787, and then, of course, you know, later the Bill of Rights. But that doesn't mean that our right to speak freely and that principle has changed, or that right has changed. The application and how we address those issues in 2025 may have a different application, but the principle is still the same. And the exact same principle is true for moral truth. And so my pastor was talking yesterday from Matthew 7 and starting in verse 24. And I'm sure for the Christians, you have all heard this before, the words of Jesus and how he talked a lot in allegory and examples. This is about the wise and foolish builders. So chapter 7 in Matthew verse 24, therefore, everyone who hears these words of mine and puts them into practice is like a wise man who built his house on the rock. The rain came down and the streams rose and the winds blew and beat against that house. Yet it did not fall because it had its foundation on the rock. But everyone who hears these words of mine and does not put them into practice is like a foolish man who built his house on sand. The rain came down and the streams rose and the winds blew and beat against that house and it fell with a great crash. So the example here, and the analogy, of course, it comes after talking about true and false disciples. So as you know, everyone who is raised in perhaps a Baptist background always knows that when you start with therefore, what's the response to that? You always want to know what it's there for, the therefore, because it comes after something else, right? So going back to up to verse 15, And then even ahead of that, verse 13, Jesus is talking first about salvation. Enter through the narrow gate, for wide is the gate and broad is the road that leads to destruction, and many enter through it. But small is the gate and narrow is the road that leads to life. Only a few find it. So then he is talking about true and false prophets, and then true and false disciples. So verse 21 says, not everyone who says to me, Lord, Lord, will enter the kingdom of heaven, but only the one who does the will of my Father who is in heaven. Many will say to me on that day, Lord, Lord, did we not prophesy in your name, and in your name drive out demons, and in your name perform many miracles? Then I will tell them plainly, Jesus is speaking, I never knew you. Away from me, you evildoers. This is a serious admonishment that not everyone who calls themselves a Christian or a disciple of Christ or a believer is genuine. And we need to be very careful. That means to not only know that we are true disciples and living the principles of Scripture and understand the truth of the gospel of salvation, but be a true disciple following the commands of the Lord. And this is all pre-political. Right? I mean, this does not depend on whether you are a Democrat or Republican, a Trump supporter or not, or whatever. This has nothing to do with the current political commentary and the controversy of our day. This is true from a not only salvific standpoint, but also moral uprightness and integrity, living our life according to Christ. And so then, after commenting on the true and false disciples, Jesus goes on to then give the allegory of the wise and foolish builders. And it struck me yesterday as I was listening to my pastor preaching on this, that I had kind of thought of the wise and foolish builders as the believers and the unbelievers, like the people who are just out living in sin. You know, they're building their foundation on sand and they are very foolish. And then when the storms came, the trials, the testing of our foundation, that's of course the part of the allegory here. Then of course their house is going to be wiped away because they're not even trying to build with integrity. They're not trying to build on a moral foundation. But the foolish builder is the person who claims to be a Christian, but then builds their foundation on principles other than the truth of the gospel of Christ. And if you build your foundation wrongly, and it's not upon the principles of God, then as you are building up, and then the winds come and the trials and the testing, then you are not built on a firm foundation. And Christians need to be very mindful of that, because we have to be solidly so well in our foundation and be a wise man building our house, building our, my pastor made the point that, you know, in this context, this was talking about the house would be like the household, the name of the person. And this can be the individual Christian. This can be your family. And this is who you are as a Christian and as a family unit. Are you building your foundation on the principles and the truth of Christ? And so what does that actually mean when we're talking about this from a concrete sense? Because a lot of Christians would say, well, you know, I'm not doing anything wrong. I try not to sin. I go to church every Sunday maybe, or, you know, I'm living my life the best way I can. And so it's a little bit esoteric, but what does sand actually mean? What does that look like? And my pastor broke it down into two categories: emotions and expectations. Because if you don't have objective truth that is grounded in the character and person of God, but you are making your decisions based on your emotions, how you feel in a given moment, what is self-satisfying, what you feel like doing in any given scenario, that is subjective. That is shakable. Or if you are building it, your foundation on expectations, that is also a category of sand, that truth is subjective. So what would expectations be? Well, what does a politician think? What do social media influencers think? What does your reputation look like according to social media? This is always changing because political policies change. Politicians change. Their cultures even change. Cultural expectations change. So that is a huge problem, that both emotions and expectations don't start with God and truth. They start with man's opinion, man's feelings. And how many of us have seen the cultural push to make decisions based on either our emotions or a bandwagon kind of fallacy where, well, this is the expectation of, you know, what the Republican Party wants or what MAGA wants or, you know, all the cool kids are doing it. This is all the social media influencing. And there's a reason why social media and influencing is very powerful and why a lot of money is spent into these campaigns, because it's basically purposefully building a psychological bandwagon fallacy. Because if everybody who you are following on social media, all of the news shows, every Fox News commentator, everybody is saying, and there's not one other opinion, then you want to join the popular crowd. You go, oh, well, that must be right then. And we need to, as Christians, be very careful that we don't fall into the trap of the bandwagon fallacy or the expectations of certain groups of society or the culture before we fundamentally are grounded in truth. And this can become very difficult because when Matthew 7 and when Jesus is talking about the rain coming and the streams rising and the winds blowing and beating against your foundation, it's not, you know, hey, if that comes sometime, you might want to be prepared. It's that will come. There will come a testing of our faith. And it may be in more mild or more minor ways daily that we're confronted with decisions. How do we respond when we're offended? For example, do we treat our neighbor with love? Do we speak truth actually in love? Do we cower in silence? I mean, all of these things that are daily questions. But then there will be the bigger trials and the bigger temptations to look at different issues from a perspective that is either completely opposed to Christ, like saying, hey, you know what? The Republican platform now is okay with gay marriage. So, you know, I'm not personally for it. Like, I can't really condemn that. And I don't want to have an opinion on that. Or, you know, I personally wouldn't ever have an abortion. Like, I can't make a judgment on somebody else's life. You know, all of those things. I mean, that's diametrically opposed to the person of truth and the character and nature of God. Why? Because God himself tells us that all human beings are created in the image of God. We and have an inherent right not only to life, but dignity and value. And that abortion is morally wrong and not justified. And we see in Genesis, pre-culture, pre-political, that God himself ordained the institution of marriage as between one man and one woman. This is part of natural law. Nature and the laws of nature and of nature is God tell us what a marriage is, and we have no authority to change that. Now, we can either actively oppose that and be completely against truth, or we can maybe, you know, twist it just a little bit and try to couch it differently and kind of straddle the fence in some ways. I mean, there are a lot of different ways to respond unbiblically and build that foundation on sand versus standing firm on a firm foundation. And for a lot of you that have followed me for a really long time, know that, you know, trials and tribulations have come in my life in various forms and ways. And I can tell you beyond a shadow of a doubt that if I were not firm in my foundation of understanding the principles of truth and to say that my Savior and following the Lord and standing firm for truth and speaking truth were not at the core of who I am and the core of what I understand is required of me. It's not voluntary. It is required of me in my Christian life. Then it would have been a much, much more difficult trial. All of the things that I faced in my life, but a lot of things very prominently. And it's not to say that it was easy going through those things. And it's not to say that it was an easy decision to make, knowing I would get a lot of, you know, hate from a lot of different people and a lot of criticism that's unfounded and a lot of, you know, false accusations, all of that. But at the end of the day, standing firm on truth and being willing to speak truth and be willing to say the principles of morality and the character and nature of God matter more than man's opinion. It matters more than politics and politicians. It matters more than the cultural expectations, perception, any of that. I fear God and not man. When trials come, if you have built your house on a firm foundation, then yeah, it's not fun going through the hurricane. I mean, I can tell you that as a Floridian now. It's not fun, but you will withstand it. And so I want to take a break here, and then we're going to come back and talk about these two controversies and how the conservatives are talking about them and how we should be talking about them if we have a pre-political understanding of truth. And if we are grounded in truth, and if we are, as Proverbs 3 verses 5 and 6 says, trusting in the Lord with all our heart, leaning not unto our own understanding, in all our ways acknowledging Him, acknowledging truth, He will direct our path. And it becomes so much simpler to understand how to think through these things if we have built our foundation solidly on Christ and fear God, not man. We'll be right back with more.
Welcome back to Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
Welcome back. And we're talking about living out the Christian life in the midst of a culture or a political ecosphere that is at in times not consistent with the biblical worldview. And that's true for the overall godless populist movement, right? And there is a great movie that you really need to see that is an example of how to be a culture warrior. And it's, in fact, titled Culture Warrior. And it is about Don Wildman, the founder of AFA. And you can go to culturewarrior.movie to watch this movie that's titled Culture Warrior, Don Wildman and the Battle for Decency. Because as a conservative Christian, you can see an example of someone who saw what's going on in culture and responded biblically, and it's led to a movement and a platform that people like me now can speak truth on a daily basis and just increase that ministry. So go to culturewarrior.movie. So let's turn to these two controversies. And I want to start with Andrew Tate because and I can't even stand talking about this guy because it just then, you know, gives him even more popularity and whatever. But I think that we need to as Christians, because there is so much out here that is talking beyond the topic of moral truth. So a couple of days ago, my good friend Josh Hammer, who we have on regularly and who is an editor at Newsweek, put out an opinion column that was very aptly titled "The Andrew Tate Moral Rot and the Future of the American Right." And I would commend that to your reading, because he's talking about this moral rot. And for those of you who don't know, this is part of the history of the Tate brothers, and this is part of what Josh Hammer writes. In 2023, Romanian authorities charged the Tate brothers with human trafficking, sexual abuse, money laundering, and forming an organized crime group to exploit and traffic women. Andrew Tate was also charged with rape. Last year, British authorities similarly procured an arrest warrant for the brothers. Andrew Tate, a convert to Islam and an unapologetic defender of Hamas, has used quote-unquote manliness to make a lot of claims that I won't even go on and read the rest of this article on air because they are just so disgusting. My friend John Root, who a lot of you know is a conservative commentator and influencer, posted a video. I was going to play a clip of this in Andrew Tate's own words that John Root was commenting on. And my producer even said, even if we bleep out some of this, it's too disgusting to even play on air. So that should give you a flavor of what Andrew Tate is advocating for. And under this concept of quote unquote manliness, it's this sort of macho kind of not even just, you know, the patriarchy, like men should make all the decisions. He's calling for actual crimes against women, and nothing whatsoever that Christians should emulate. And yet, because he has such a popular following, he has been platformed by so many conservatives and even influencers that some of you may listen to and go to. And this is why we need to be very careful consumers. And the Tampa Bay Young Republicans, which is a group that I have spoken to here in Florida, they posted this in the midst of this controversy, as the Tate brothers are apparently coming to Florida or have already. TBYR, Tampa Bay Young Republicans, formally welcomes the Tates to Florida as free speech absolutists. The Tates haven't been formally convicted of any crimes and are welcome to speak to our group. We're old enough to remember when a quote unquote convicted felon won the presidency. Hashtag free state. All right. So if we are not thinking Christianly and we're just looking at this, then like a lot of conservatives, you're kind of parsing this like, well, you know, I disagree with what he says, and, you know, I'm not going to, but, you know, hey, he has the right to speak it. And so since they haven't been convicted of any crimes yet, you know, free speech and the right to innocence until proven guilty, you know, all of those are American principles. So go team, you know. Well, free speech is not the issue here. This is not about the government coming in, the American government coming in and trying to tell Andrew Tate, like, hey, you can't be this, you know, insane machismo over here on social media, and then the principle of free speech might apply. There are some things that even the Supreme Court has recognized don't fall under free speech. By the way, hate speech not being one of them. That's a leftist thing. But if we're actually understanding the moral principle here, we don't, as Christians, say, well, you know, they haven't been convicted of anything, so we're going to welcome them and celebrate them and platform their message under the auspices of free speech. And by the way, free speech absolutism does not mean that you welcome every speaker or affirm every message. And conservatives, even not Christians, have long fought for that very principle, that the government cannot compel us to speak against our sincerely held religious beliefs or refrain from speaking them. So free speech absolutism does not mean that you say, hey, you haven't been convicted of a crime, so there, we gotta say, you know, hey, we formally invite you and we welcome you and we platform you because we have to. That's actually a misconstruing and a twisting and a perverting of what First Amendment doctrine and free speech actually means. But that's not even the point. The point is that if we are looking at this through a moral lens, then we're not going to platform these people anyway. And I'm already running out of time, but we'll have to continue the conversation tomorrow because I wanted to comment on the Epstein files. And so I'll just tease this a little bit of how a lot of these influencers who are going around saying, well, because the Trump administration has allegedly and reportedly facilitated, you know, Trump coming in, they're saying that they want to put out the Epstein files and all this. Well, we got to go along with that. We can't have any other opinion than supporting what the administration is doing, because as conservatives, you know, then that's always right. That is going along with expectations and building your house on sand, because ultimately then you will be advocating for things that are diametrically opposed to your moral grounding as a Christian. And you will be people like Benny Johnson, who claims to be a Christian, like Alina Haba. I'm not sure if she claims to be a Christian or not, but you are going out and saying they're big fans of Andrew Tate, of platforming them, like the Young Republicans. And saying, well, you know, hey, of course we disagree with what he says, but, you know, they have been persecuted in the same way Trump has, so we need to champion them. No, we don't. Absolutely not. And so if we are going to look at the moral truth of an issue pre-political, it doesn't matter what the expectation of MAGA or the expectation of the Republican Party or the expectation of the Democrat Party, the expectation of a politician, it doesn't matter. The question is, what does God expect of you? And God expects you to stand up firmly and call out the moral rot and say, no, we don't welcome people who are calling for beating and raping of women to be welcomed on a platform that is supposedly conservative, which should be the party of moral truth. It is totally, completely inconsistent. We have to start with morality before we even get to the conservative issues. We'll talk about this more tomorrow. Already out of time.
The views and opinions expressed in this broadcast may not necessarily reflect those of the American Family Association or American Family Radio.
We'd like to thank our sponsors, including Preborn. Preborn has rescued over 200,000 babies from abortion, and every day their network clinics rescue 200 babies' lives. Will you join Preborn in loving and supporting young moms in crisis? Save a life today. Go to preborn.com.